Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Subscribe to the Van Leer series on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere you find your podcasts. I'm pleased to welcome Umit Kurt to the show today to talk about his new book, Armenians of Ain Tab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. Umit Kurt is a Polonsky Fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute and an Australian Research Council Fellow. His books, published in both Turkish and English, include The Spirit of the Laws, The Plunder of Wealth in the Armenian Genocide. Umit Kurt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me today.
Umit, the subtitle of your book, The Economics of Genocide, is a chilling phrase. Why do you believe economics to have been the primary motivator for the Turkish mass murder of Armenians?
Actually, it was one of the important motivations for the perpetrators, the active participants of this collective violence event. The prospect of loot, particularly, incentivizes local collaborators to support massacres and deportations. And realizing this potential, the Committee of Union and Progress, the Ottoman ruling government, who carried out the Armenian genocide in 1915 and 1918, political leadership deliberately instrumentalize the promise of spoil and plunder to cajole public participation. And the central government was well aware of the fact that provincial notables, local landowners, and bigwigs, officials, and a range of other people with vested interests tried to take possession of Armenian wealth. So these actors found themselves in a fortuitous position. Not only did their actions fulfill the ideological requirements of the regime, but these actions also brought material gain in the form of expropriated and pillaged Armenian properties. So these factors in combination serve to catalyze further the persecution of Armenians. Therefore, what I call is reward mechanism, which was created by which the CUP government could draw political and social support for decisions to deport and massacre Armenians. The profiteers justify their confiscation and seizure of Armenian wealth not as a robbery or plunder, but as a fair reward for their participation in the elimination of harmful and treacherous elements in their eyes. Thus, beyond base greed, this fervor with which they executed the genocide on the local level must be understood in part as a result of the rationalization that they were acting in the service of the Ottoman state as well.
So you needed both the ideological basis and the economic motivation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, these two factors, most of the time, over the course of persecution of Armenians, both physically, economically, and politically, went hand in hand in the whole process.
Now, when you use the word genocide, do you mean it in the original sense, that is, the campaign to annihilate an entire race or ethnic group and erase its culture? Because today it's often used more loosely than it was when the word was coined, and it often is used to mean something more ambiguous.
It's a wonderful question, actually, and which begs for analytical exploration in the field of genocide studies in general and in the field of Armenian genocide studies in particular. I use the word genocide as a phenomenon and concept coined by Raphael Lemkin to explain various aspects of the destruction of a community, a nation, a group of people, or religious group. It can be a religious group, it can be a national group, it can be ethno-religious group, or it can be a race, and so forth. In the case of Armenian genocide, I am also inviting scholars to revisit and reevaluate to apply the notion of genocide coined by Raphael Lemkin. Because in my book, I am not only explaining and analyzing Armenian genocide by solely concentrating on physical destruction of these people. Besides that, and more importantly, I am trying to show how genocide was executed, carried out by the Ottoman government, the CUP, and also active participation of local elites and bigwigs and ordinary Muslims by focusing on property confiscation. Not only physical elimination of these people, but how their economic walks of life were erased and removed, which made them actually in a destitute position, especially in the deportation roads. These people, Armenians, who were deported and who were forcibly gotten out of their homes and put in the deportation caravans and roads, they were left penniless, even to corrupt the so-called security guards on the deportation roads. So the rationale for the removal of Armenians was that the group posed a threat of rebellion, although that was the rationale. My book shows that that's the reason why the prospect of material gain was a key motivator of support for the Armenian genocide among the local Muslim gentry and Turkish Republic.
Well, did the Armenians pose a threat to the government? Were there rebellious groups within them? And could they have escaped death and confiscation of their property by converting to Islam?
In the case of Aintab, let's say, I think your question, we should, in order to answer your properly answer your question, we should look at the regional variations. We should look at case by case and region by region, district by district. In the case of Aintab, I intentionally picked this city where I was born and grown up, is that Armenians and Muslims, including Kurds, Arabs, Turks, Circassians, Caucasians, and so on and so forth, these people lived, relatively speaking, in an harmonious way until a certain time period, especially until 1895, when the Hamidi massacres took place in the town. Armenian community, of course, was politicized in the late 19th century, especially. And this politization was a result of a various reasons and historical factors. But this politization also occurred, the politicization of other groups, including Muslims. So Armenians, at some point in 1915, were regarded as the fifth column, as enemy, even enemy alien citizens. And the slaughter and the plunder followed a deliberated and declared intent on the part of local perpetrators who were assisted in their deadly campaign by the Ottoman central authorities. So while the pattern of destruction remained locally determined, the central government provided the overall context that allowed for sustained human rights abuses and crime against humanity. In the case of Aintab, a suitable sociopolitical atmosphere was created through the relentless efforts of the Muslim elites to lobby the central authorities to deport Armenians, whose deportation these elites then facilitate in return for obtaining the Armenians' abundant material riches. And during 1915, these elites propagandized against Armenians, presenting them spuriously as a rebellious threat, as had been done previously in 1895, as I have just pointed out. So the seizure and transfer of Armenian property undergirded popular support for the deportation and ultimate elimination of their fellow citizens. So Armenians had constituted the middle and upper middle class of the Aintab population, and they had predominated in manufacturing, agricultural production, and interregional trade. Therefore, their expulsion was a moment for opportunity for the bandits who robbed Armenians of their personal belongings on the road, and especially for Aintab's Muslim elites who seized the assets and properties the Armenians left behind. Conversion certainly took place in the city. Some Armenians, a very limited number of Armenians in the city, were, I don't want to use the word choice or preference, but they were forced to get converted to Islam in order to get away with deportation order. And that way, they managed to secure some of their properties, not the whole entire amount of their wealth. So converted Armenians' properties were even subject to confiscation and seizure as well. So what I'm trying to say is that conversion was not kind of a final outlet for Armenians to keep themselves away from deportation and other harsh measures.
That sounds similar to what happened in the Inquisition in the Middle Ages, when the Catholic Church took the property of the infidels, and conversion seemed like a way out, but not completely. Ümit, you're Turkish. And as I understand it, the Armenian genocide is still a controversial topic in Turkey, whose current Islamist government denies that it took place at all and is quite a repressive government. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that right now Turkey has more academics and journalists in prison than any other country. And I'm not sure that's correct, but I read that somewhere. At any rate, my real question is, have you experienced any personal repercussions to this study and the publication of the book?
I would talk about a few pushbacks, let's see, over the course of my research in the first place and then after the publication of my book. So, especially while conducting my research in local archives and libraries in Gaziantep, so Aintab, the modern-day Gaziantep. So I faced with local administrative hurdles, let's say. And this professor, Hakan Yavuz, in the University of Utah, so allegedly working for Turkish government under their payroll, sent me a few slender emails because of nature and content of work I was doing. Same guy sent letters to the Gaziantep governorship and asked it to ban me from entering local archives and libraries in the city. And another fellow man, another native of Aintab, late Hasan Celal Güzel, who was a former Minister of Education, Youth and Sport, and he was a deputy in the Turkish parliament, also initiated a smear campaign against me and exerted strenuous efforts to prevent me from doing my research in the city. And since my research and later book proved and documented that many family members became affluent and constitute new bourgeois or elite class of the Sydney in the Republican period by seizing properties and lands of Armenians, and many prominent families and their descendants especially made certain attempts to impede me, and I receive a couple of, I mean, preposterous, let's say, emails from descendants of these families, and threatening me and swearing me and saying all these bad words and threatening me to open a lawsuit against me and stuff like that. And that also in a way shows I kind of disturb by telling the narrative, the real story itself, which has been forgotten and which was supposed to be forgotten in their eyes. So these are the major hurdles I have received up until now, let's say.
But no physical threats and no threats from the government.
I am sure I am in the blacklist of government, but thank God I haven't received any physical threat and so forth. And I must say that I was quite comfortable to work in the Prime Ministerial Ottoman Archives, which is based in Istanbul. And I only had a few hardships and difficulties while doing my research in my hometown itself. And also, maybe I should give you this recent incident which happened to me like almost a month ago. I was back home in Aintab, so I paid my family a visit. And I went to Papyrus Cafe, you know the story in my book, in the foreword of the book. I mean, the Papyrus Cafe, which was an Armenian house owned by Iranian honorary consul Nazar Nazarian. And you know, the whole story of mine started when I happened to learn this house was an Armenian, what belonged to an Armenian, and it was converted into a coffee shop and so forth. So I used to go to this coffee shop all the time, and I was quite welcome all the time. But last month, I visit the coffee shop to meet a friend of mine. When I was in the coffee shop, the owner of the place really, really cast a doubtful and eyes on me, and the other employers of him, they kind of, I mean, let's say that I saw the anger and indignation, their eyes and their gestures and so forth. I was for the first time over the course of my research, for the first time, I was really terrified. I felt the trepidation, and so I was about to leave the place immediately, but employees of the owner, they were trying to approach me. And Kurdish people in the same coffee shop, they also know my work and they are supportive of my work. They are interested in my work. You know, these Kurdish guys, young guys, they kind of protected me, let's say. They invited me to sit with them and have tea with them. And they kind of, you know, circle me against these guys, employees and so forth. So I was, let's say, off the hook, so to speak. And now I felt really for the first time this kind of fear or worrisome, most importantly. And then I realized really to work and do research or write a book, an article on this subject matter is getting more and more difficult in Turkey. Because of the political situation, as you have just pointed out, it's extremely bleak and grim, and this repressive atmosphere is really, really getting aggravated day by day in the country, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. Let's move back in time. You did give us some historical and regional context. it was a time when the world was in turmoil, World War I. Well, I'll let you answer it. How would you say the Ottoman Empire's campaign against the Armenians, and I might add other minorities as well, during the First World War, how was it different from the persecution of minorities in other countries at that time? Or was it not different?
Sure. It's I think it's an important question in order to contextualize what happened to Armenians. I mean, what kind of violence was inflicted upon the Armenians and which was affected by this global dynamic of violence at that time. First of all, the Ottoman Empire's participation in World War I included a major campaign aimed at eliminating certain minorities, first and foremost Armenians, Greeks, and Assyrian population entirely as well. And these minorities were depicted by the CUP regime and Muslim society as dangerous and treacherous domestic enemies. And this campaign led Armenians to be subjected to wartime mass deportation, internment, total extermination, and expropriation. However, the Ottoman Empire was by no means the only state to take measures against its own citizens. Both Central and Allied powers carried out brutal policies against domestic political suspects and enemy aliens during the years 1914-1918. For example, Russia's campaign against its enemy citizens quickly widened in scope to include the empire's large population of ethnic Germans, Russian subject Jews, Muslims, and others. And the Poles as well, of course. Yet, only in one state, the Ottoman Empire, did this dynamic of destruction get pushed as far as genocide. In others, including Austria-Hungary, the quest for military security had murderous rather than genocidal consequences. So, pursuing this global dynamic of violence during the Great War, the Committee of Union and Progress Party's campaign resulted in the forced displacement of more than a million civilians, the nationalization of a substantial portion of the imperial economy, and the transfer of extensive lands, assets, and properties from the targeted minorities, Armenians, Greeks, and Assyrians, to favored groups. Historically, few governments formally took measures in times of war against their own subjects. You know, however, as renowned historian Eric Lohr underscores, World War I introduced systematic and brutal measures against enemy citizens and other civilians. Measures that proliferated both during and after World War II. One cornerstone of wartime campaign against Armenians in the Ottoman Empire was the confiscation of their properties and wealth, which were subsequently transferred to Muslim elites and used in reshaping the domestic economy as well as covering wartime expenses. There were among the radical practices of the CUP regime aimed at nationalizing the economy. First, many businesses and properties were transferred to state institutions. Second, a lesser but substantial number of firms were transferred to reliable Muslim individuals and social institutions. Exactly the same process occurred in Tsarist Russia against the enemy alien citizens, the category which was created by the Russian Empire, by the Tsar, to create a kind of ethnicity regimes. And all these nationalizing state policies were carried out in the Tsarist Russia as well. More significant than the transfers themselves was the fact that these extraordinary measures belonged to a set of laws, regulations, rules, and decrees that created so-called a legal basis for a more systematic campaign against the movable and immovable properties of Armenians. Exactly in this context, I am substantiating the notion of genocide. I am applying the notion of genocide to this process rather than solely focusing on physical elimination or performance of physical violence in the deportation roads or also in the concentration camps against the Armenians. On the other hand, I am systematically and meticulously analyzing the legal rules and regulation and bureaucratic mechanisms which culminated in the destruction of Armenians and totally obliterate economic walks of life of this population.
And so that's how you're distinguishing murderous versus genocidal.
Absolutely.
Okay. In the book, you use words like plunder and spoils, words that are, for me, at least this one reader, evocative of ancient battles rather than modern times.
Yeah.
If plunder, well, greed, was critical in mobilizing local participation in the Armenian genocide, do you believe or do you know whether they were similarly, whether it, greed, was similarly pivotal in other 20th century genocides in Asia, Cambodia, in Rwanda, in Africa, and of course, on an incomparable scale, the European Holocaust?
I think there are similar patterns and also convergences between these mass violence events, as genocide, including the Holocaust. Greed is one of those patterns, and also plunder and spoil the same. I think these kind of patterns can be observed in almost most of the mass crimes, as you have mentioned. And in the case of Armenian genocide and Aintab, as how the local version of Armenian genocide took place, we see a kind of a dual track mechanism, which means the following: plunder and spoil, and let's say confiscation and liquidation of Armenian mobile and immobile properties under the veneer of legality went in tandem as well. So on the one hand, at the local level, at the periphery, Ottoman periphery in Asia Minor, there were huge plunder and spoil incidents happening, which were uncontrolled by the Ottoman government. And they also condone those violent acts in order to get support and consent of these ordinary people, most and for, of course, local elites, provincial notables as well, but also the mass support which they urgently needed in order to carry out this mass violent event, because this promise of economic power rallied active support for participation in micro-policy operated by the CUP that aimed to annihilate all of Turkey's Armenians. And in fact, it was the drive for material gain that led administrative, political, local, and civil actors to pragmatically engage in the eradication of Armenians more actively than the central authorities. And more important, property theft and material benefits acquired from the victims were an important means of further binding the beneficiaries to one another and the CUP regime itself. As early as March 1915, Aintab's provincial notables, for example, and landowners, as well as municipal officials and other bigwigs, were casting covetous eyes on Armenian property. And Istanbul government was well aware of these desires. So in order to fulfill its policy of destruction, the Committee of Union and Progress in the party was required to make concessions. So therefore, One could argue that what motivated urban Muslim Aintab notables to join the CUP and take part in its genocidal policies was self-interest rather than a shared ideology. But I'm not here saying ideology does not play a role in the destruction of Armenians. But much of the implementation was enacted by local elites and the Muslim population at large out of a base desire to plunder the assets and property of Armenian community instead of the generally assumed ideological pressure and encouragements of the political center. I think this aspect is quite conspicuous in other mass violence events, especially Cambodia, you know, Holocaust, and the local version of Holocaust, especially in Eastern Europe. I think the noteworthy historian Ömer Bartol's recent work on Buchaç is a very, very good example to substantiate what I have just, you know, mentioned.
Now, you've mentioned the term local elites and notables a few times in our conversation, and you write about their role very much in your book. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about what does the term local elites mean in the Aintab or more generally the Turkish context, and how does it compare to the social structure of other Muslim societies? I mean, elite, every culture, I believe, has its elites, but they're not always the same. So talk about that a little bit. Who are the elites or were?
Sure. So this concept, the concept of local or provincial elites, so it's central to my understanding of the elite-making process, first and foremost. The term provincial elites is generally associated with Ayan, notables, I mean, who held a dominant place in the Ottoman provinces beginning in the late 17th century. Political, social, and economic power was the defining feature of these provincial elites, predominantly Muslims. Not only did they include members of the military, the learned institutions dedicated to education, religious personnel, administrative staff, and artisans, but they also occasionally consisted of dervish sheikhs, you know, just religious leaders, women, and even non-Muslims. So they could facilitate the implementation of government policies and guarantee relative order in the provinces. In turn, state acknowledgement or government appointment enhance these local notables' prestige and authority. Local notables with some political power comprise of more modest families. These Ayan families, I mean the notables, had more in common with contemporary patriciates in Europe than the military magnates of the Ottoman realm. So the participation of the local populace in that sense in robbing their Armenian neighbors is seen as the product of an increasing radicalization and loss of restraint resulting from the breakdown of social ties among these, you know, Muslim elites and the non-Muslim population of the city and also the empire itself, along ethnic, religious, and economic lines. So these features of Ayans or notables or provincial elites distinguish themselves from other Muslim subjects or citizens of the empire. And these elites were quite functional and operational and active in terms of galvanizing and provoking and spearheading ordinary Muslims. They used and manipulated and provoked the rage and indignation of Muslim population, Muslim people, Arabs, Kurds, Turks, and so forth, through the channel of violence, which was inflicted upon Armenians under ripe circumstances in the city. First eruption of this violence took place in November 1895 under the reign of Abdülhamid II. The Hamidi massacres, which lasted 3 days in the city, took place. And in 1915, this violence showed itself as shocking waves. And what we see in Aintab in 1915 was not only an outbreak of a sudden and you know, violence like pogroms, but what we see is a theaters of violence and the various and manifold aspects of violence was taking place in the city in 1915.
Now, of course, violence becomes more likely once it happens. So there was the background of 1895. But when you come to 1915, if I understood your book correctly, the central government's plan was to deport the Armenians and steal their property. Was there an inflection point or an idea that happened? And how did that policy of deportation develop into mass violence?
From 1895 until 1915, let's say, Muslims and Armenians of Aintab, who had previously coexisted in relative harmony, so they turned against one another, with the former committing inconceivable acts against the latter. So, in my work, the lens through which intercommunal and state minority relations are viewed is primarily an economic one. But in a broad sense of that term, with political economy entailing law, commerce, property relations, and socioeconomic tensions, economic rivalries were overladen on ethno-religious hierarchies in the late 19th century in Aintab. So the belief among members of the dominant nation that the normative social order was being gravely upset was shaped by the nationalization of the Armenian nation under the modernizing influence of a burgeoning Armenian middle class. An international pressure for reforms to ensure the rights of and protection for Armenians seemed to confirm this impression. So, 1895 massacres featured extensive plunder of Aintab Armenians too, which was an integral step in restoring the hierarchy that the massacres augured. Important members of Aintab's urban Muslim elite, clergy, and local government were implicated in scapegoating Armenians and in cheerleading the killing. More so, it appears, than Abdülhamid II's central regime. So the same elites joined the local CUP branch in the second constitutional period in 1908, which at once safeguarded their social power, gave them influence in the new ruling regime, and gave the CUP a kind of conduit into local affairs. Although this period at first appeared to create a sense of calm by placing both committees on an equal level, ethnic tensions soon reemerged. Different segments of Muslim community in Aintab were deeply disturbed by their perception that the restoration of the constitution mainly favored Armenians. So this so-called equality further exacerbated feelings of resentment toward the Armenians of the city as the Ottoman Empire continued to decline politically and economically. In turn, ethno-economic identities became dangerously pronounced and bred more violence, which ultimately erupted in Adana and its outskirts in 1909, for instance. The Adana massacres proved how fragile the values of the Young Turk Revolution were and consequently created a general atmosphere of insecurity, leading to general mobilization and ultimately deportations in Aintab. Once the deportations began, Aintab gentry were well positioned to appropriate Armenian goods, properties, and businesses, either directly or via the good offices of the abandoned property commissions and liquidation commissions, indirectly through the state. The CUP functionaries of Aintab, including Ali Cenani, a prominent landowner and the local elite, District Governor Ahmet Faik Bey, and Bulaşıkzade Müfti Arif Efendi, a general secretary of the local CUP branch in the city, people in good standing with them, and war veterans were those most likely to receive monies, businesses, and properties, or to lease them for nominal fees, in turn, transform those people into capitalists. So by taking up the cause of the CUP and the ethnic Turkish nationalism, the leading families of Aintab, Cenanizade, Mennanzade, Tahçezade, Istırapzade, Daizade, Kethudazade, Göğüş, Battalzade, Hacı Azade families, and so forth, secured their control over the local CUP organization and parliamentary representation for the city. So these individuals were far from the only beneficiaries. Direct perpetrators of the massacres often had their own pecuniary motives. So weaving the entirety of the process, the function of appropriation was as important as the individual purposes. Huge numbers of people were bound together in a circle of profit that was at the same time a circle of complicity.
Yeah, complicated, many strains fused together to result in this outcome. What did you mean when you wrote, and you say it in the name of another scholar, Raphael Lemkin, who, as you mentioned, coined the term genocide after World War II, that genocide is both a process of destruction and a process of construction?
Yep. It's another significant question in the literature of mass violence, and which has been discussing in the state of art so far. I should highlight one point maybe. So killing and even murdering other people, terrorizing, humiliating, dehumanizing, causing harm to them, is not just destructive. For those who perpetrate violence and terror, it's creative and rewarding. Why? Because it generates a social dynamic. Perpetrators and bystanders energize social life and build collective identity through committing genocide. Desire for community, the experience of belonging, and the ethos of collectivity became the basis of mass murder. We should vividly see this aspect in the case of Holocaust, especially the participation of different sections of society in destruction of Jews, especially in Eastern Europe. In the same way, as well as eradicating the Armenian community, deportation was a means of reorienting the Muslim population to a new ideological identity. More than enriching individual perpetrators, plunder was a way of rewarding the quote-unquote reliable, resourcing immigrants and refugees in order to properly integrate them, and creating a Turkish Muslim bourgeoisie as a driver of national modernization in a Darwinian world of struggle.
In a recent public presentation, conversation, you said, quote, "Violence produces ethnic conflict, especially in the Middle East." Talk about that. What did you mean?
Yeah. Actually, I borrow this term or argumentation from another important scholar and historian, Laura Robson. And I am entirely on the same page with her by arguing that. Especially in the Middle East and in the Ottoman Empire, which can be regarded under the same geography, within the same context, the conventional argument has for a long time argued that you know, ethnic differences, ethnic fault lines, ethno-religious, you know, rifts create or cause or gave or give rise to violence, you know, in different parts of Middle East, in the case of Armenian genocide, in the case of Greek expulsion from the Asian littoral cities of the Ottoman Empire in Asia Minor, and so on and so forth. But the point is, these people, either Muslims, Muslim, or either Greek and Ottoman Assyrian, Ottoman Armenian, and so forth, they used to live together in the same neighborhood. They were brethren with one another. And when they were living under, you know, calm and stable conditions and or circumstances, they kind of found a way of coexistence to live together for a long term in the Ottoman Empire. Back then, these ethnic identities were not identificator for them to delineate themselves as a social position, maybe an economic class, or in their position or place in the community. But when violence broke out, inter-ethnic strife and violence especially broke out, and then the same people start to define themselves as Kurd, as Arab, as Armenian, as Assyrian, as Protestant Armenian, as Catholic Armenian, and so on and so forth. So these kind of superficial and constructed ethnic and sectarian identities came into historical existence immediately after the violence broke out. When the violence is on the ground, people start to define themselves in ethnic terms. So by saying violence produces ethnic fault lines, not the other way around, I mean that. So we shouldn't forget the fact that collective paranoia and the fear, the climate of fear, which are produced by politicians, by political elites, civil or military bureaucrats, these atmosphere, this collective paranoia, it's like an industry. If as political elite you find a cost client to buy this, and then, you know, ethnic identifications, ethnic fault lines, ethno-religious identities, and so on and so forth, these kind of notions come into scene. It's like an industry. If it depends on demand and supply in society.
So would you say from that perspective that ethnic conflict is more likely to be a step on the road to genocide or something along that continuum? Or is it more likely to get enacted like a war between nations?
I would say it's one of the episodes within the whole process. Because as Raphael Lemkin kept saying, genocide is a process, and it's a social dynamics and so forth. So ethnic conflicts or ethnic cleansing, let's say, is one of the episodes of collective violence. But that does not necessarily mean that ethnic violence or ethnic cleansing would immediately or automatically or organically turn into genocidal violence. These kind of events, especially in mass violence or collective violence incidents, do not go along a linear line or a straightforward line. You know, there are episodes and moments the way in which ethnic cleansing even can be prevented or can be turned away, or it can transform itself into genocidal violence. And it depends on the context. It varies from region to region. It varies from episode to episode, moment to moment. So this is the way I see mass violence incidents, not only in the Middle East or in the Ottoman world, but also in other topographies and geographies as well.
finally, Umit, did your research provide any insight into those people who stand up and refuse to participate in the socially sanctioned killing of their neighbors? And has it given you any thoughts about how the next genocide can be prevented?
Actually, it's I haven't received so much feedback from that aspect. So how genocide can be prevented? And first, it needs recognition. It needs acknowledgement. Now, Turkey and also my fellow citizens back home in Aintab, they are so far away from acknowledging this this crime, this collective crime. By the way, publicly, they do not, they are not willing to acknowledge this publicly, or they are not willing to accept it as a public knowledge. But in their inside, in internal conversations or conversation with me, one-to-one encounter, they are not hesitant or avoiding acknowledging it. What happened to them? They knew pretty well. They learned it from their great-grandfathers and the old history they know. They know that their Armenian neighborhood did exist in this city. These houses, which were transformed into coffee shops, converted to boutique hotels and so forth. There were Armenian residents, neighbors living in those places. They know this for sure as a fact. But they do not want to articulate it in public because they are so afraid of the legal and economic ramifications of this acknowledgement.
Well, that makes perfect sense, that reluctance. And as far as prevention?
For prevention, it starts, I think, with memorialization of what happened to Armenians, remembrance of what happened to their Armenian neighbors. And we should maybe initiate a grassroots level kind of initiatives to take. And we should change like a curriculum of Turkish history education system in primary school, starting with the primary schools and so forth. And also, we shouldn't forget the fact that denial in Turkey does not only stem from or come from the state itself. Denial in Turkey is being so much supported and reinforced for society, different sections of society in Turkey. So that's why we need a really, really a thoughtful and also a very analytical and a democratic kind of education system and democratic atmosphere and political climate in Turkey in order to discuss this matter, which can open avenues for us to think about how to prevent the same crime wouldn't happen in Turkey. But for the time being, it's almost unlikely to carve out or create that kind of atmosphere in Turkey, in the country, under this repressive political atmosphere, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. And it's a serious and chilling topic. Thank you, Umit, for taking the time to share your research with us. Before you go, tell us what's next for you.
Thank you. I'm working on two book projects now. One deals with the microdynamics of restraint of violence and what micro mechanisms make restraint possible on the ground by focusing on a very interesting adultery incident, which occurred in Adapazarı in 1911. Now I'm changing my subject matter. I'm changing the location as well. Now, actually, for a long while, I have been working on how the violence was carried out by different sections of society, and now I'm working on how the restraint of violence. You know,
that's what we need.
Yes, and what mechanisms make this restraint possible? And through this particular adultery incident, I'm trying to explain why intercommunal killings happen in some situation, but not in others. So, I develop a kind of careful microhistorical research to reveal certain local factors that lead to restraint. My other book project focuses on a genocide perpetrator, Mustafa Reşat Mimaroğlu, who emerged from a genocidal society and attained influential positions in post-genocide Turkey. This guy was the one who carried out arrest of Armenian intellectuals and politicians on 24th of April 1915. I examine continuation of genocidal regime in modern Turkish Republic and how genocides, such as this guy Mimaroğlu, constitute core elements of new state by examining his life and his relationships with well-known and prominent Armenian intellectual Diran Kelekyan, who was arrested by his former student Mimaroğlu, the same guy, from Darül Fünun Şahane. So in doing this project, I want to show and substantiate the fact that Turkish Republic was founded by genocide perpetrators, and these people climbed to higher echelons of the state due to their connivance and contributions they offered for this criminal complicity.
Well, lots of good luck with both those projects, and they seem to be a good balance for you, for your own mental health, to have both restraint as well as...
I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Umit.
Thank you for having me, Rene.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov. Bye-bye.